Today on Against the Grain, it's often observed that the Democratic Party paved the way for Trump's rise.
To the question of like the kind of faith in the markets, faith in capitalism, that is a sort of key component here, but it's a belief in kind of markets and capitalism to in some ways like address particular kinds of traditionally liberal goals.
Historian Lily Geismer discusses how we got here, examining the remaking of liberalism and the Democratic Party, populated by a professionally trained technocratic elite who did what technocrats do, tweaking the system, not fundamentally changing it. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Since the 60s, liberalism has been the domain of professionally trained managers, lawyers, and other experts. My guest, Lily Geismer, along with Brent Siebel, co-edited a collection of essays examining the form and consequences of liberalism's transformation called Mastery and Drift, Professional Class Liberals Since the 1960s. She's professor of history at Claremont McKenna College and the author of Left Behind, The Democrats' Failed Attempt to Solve Inequality. Lily, progressives and people on the left often fume about the Democratic Party's ineptitude at confronting the right or their half-hearted attempts, seeing a kind of fundamental lack of energy or will to confront the right. Do you think that a lack of energy is enough to explain that phenomenon?
The short answer is no, but I'll give a longer answer to it. I think there are two parts to the question of this issue of the Democrats' sort of inability to fight the right. I think on one hand, it has to do with this way in which like actually the Democratic Party or liberalism has been so defined by the right. So in some ways, like by what it's not. And some of those questions of like, it's not actually efficient to solve the, like, it's not, they're not effective in solving the, addressing the right, is addressing a Democratic Party that's only there in response to these threats from the right, as opposed to like actually having a coherent, robust vision of its own. So in some ways, like, that's the solution, is like to have a much more, active and robust vision than acting in response to the right. I do think there has been a tendency, and I think it has much longer historical roots, and this is something that in my newest project, Mastery and Drift, we trace the sort of long tradition of, but is the kind of the Democrats and a particular version of liberalism, which we call professional class liberalism's sort of adherence to kind of procedural norms and this commitment like to the system and to the legal system that has often made it less effective in fighting, particularly the version of the right that has emerged in the last 10 to 15 years. So I think that like this question of often trying to like use procedure, like things like the sort of like faith in the legal system as the response has been limited. And one thing that we've seen happen, I mean, one place I think you can actually see a kind of a shift from and departure has actually been the success of the proposition in California to do redistricting. But that actually is like a sort of break from traditional democratic patterns or norms to go against the kind of the system.
And we'll return to the present as we go. But just to understand how the Democratic Party got to where it is and to see the place of professional class liberals within the Democratic Party, I wanted to ask you, what did liberalism look like before the 1960s?
Yeah, I think that one thing that's important is that liberalism itself is such a sort of fraught term. And one of the things that I think comes up is actually understanding its like historic evolution and really the kind of roots of modern liberalism. And that can be like an extent that like a long term really date themselves to the New Deal. So that's kind of this kind of origin point of a kind of new type of liberalism that really believed in a strong federal government, a belief in the role of government to help people in need. It did have components of it that really sort of that bolstered versions of market capitalism. And that was another key part of it, was like a commitment to economic growth. And so we see those commitments and individual rights play out within the post-war period. And so much of the kind of what we call post-war liberalism, or the kind of like because of the kind of embrace of Keynesian forms of economics and political economy, lead to the kind of a particular like sort of commitment to economic growth, and then a kind of compensatory social welfare state. You also see the kind of like the other side of liberalism is like this liberal coalition that emerges around the New Deal, and primarily with union members and a kind of connection to organized labor as its base. But one of the things that's like really sort of fundamental to like the kind of liberalism of the 50s is like this faith in, is also a faith in kind of particular forms of like bureaucracy and big government. And it does have a kind of technocratic dimension to it. So those are the kinds of origins of like what we associate with like post-war liberalism.
You, as you mentioned, you focus in Mastery and Drift on the class of, or on the strata of liberals who come out of the professional class in various ways, technocrats, managers, lawyers, experts of various kinds, bureaucrats. Why do you focus on that strata? Why do you think they are so important to understand the remaking of the Democratic Party?
I mean, one thing that they're a group that has gotten a lot of attention, more under the category of like the sort of the PMC or the professional managerial class, in the kind of aftermath of the 2016 election in particular, and understanding this group is kind of really sort of becoming the kind of base of the Democratic Party. And this is something that I've looked at extensively in my own work, or my individual work, first looking at kind of suburban liberals, and who are knowledge workers, and how they become sort of so fundamental to the base. But under what things you wanted to do in this book was to sort of think about that, and this is my co-author, or co-editor Brent Siebel, and I, and the other authors in the book, was to sort of think about this as a bigger thing that's not just about the kind of base of the party or it's like its voters, but also to understand how it's come to sort of shape its approach to government and to policy. And so one of the things that we began to do as we thought about it more was to sort of look back to this kind of actually post-war moment, where one of the things that happened from the New Deal, and particularly like the kind of growth liberalism, but especially the kind of the rise of the Cold War, was increased investment and expansion of universities. And so you can especially see, this is another thing you can see in California, was this huge growth of the public university system, and a new expanded generation of people who were going to college. And then many of them went on to go, who are like sort of middle class, and had this kind of abiding faith in kind of meritocracy, opportunity. And a lot of them go on to then get professional degrees at law school, public policy schools, business schools. So you have this huge growth of those professional schools in the 60s and 70s and beyond. And so the question that we were interested in is like having this new sort of this expanded cohort of people who also then go into positions in government, and often in, you know, either in the kind of broader federal government or then, you know, affiliated with particular parties, and bring that to the kind of training and ethos, especially around kind of law school, which trains you to think in particular ways, bringing that applications of that into kind of policy and governance. And so one of our questions is the ways in which that sort of puts particular kinds of constraints on the kind of liberal vision. So this kind of like, if you think about, if you're, and this is not to just like hate on lawyers, but if you have that kind of approach of kind of very much like working within the system, kind of tweaking the system, that really sort of starts to apply to the ways that these people come to think about government and policy. And so we saw this as kind of some of like the persistence of liberalism, but also its fundamental limitations and why it's so frustrating. And this goes back to your original question, like it's so frustrating, particularly to many people on the left who would like more comprehensive and robust solutions.
So out of what class or classes did these people come from by and large? You know, you talked about kind of the explosion of professional training, graduate programs, people going into the law or public policy or other specialized fields. What were their backgrounds by and large, and what did this group look like in terms of gender and race?
Yeah, well, one thing that's interesting to the gender and race question is you also, due to affirmative action in the 1970s and 1980s, have a growing number of both women, especially women and then people of color, who are taking a new position. So this goes to like a kind of embrace of certain forms of diversity, but also a kind of diversity that's like very tied to ideas of both meritocracy and then also a kind of middle class or upper middle class. And so that goes to the kind of class composition that this kind of training starts to intensify, which is like this very kind of middle class or upper middle class, both kind of composition, but also I would say outlook too.
And how did these people, as they were coming of age, think about the liberal state itself in the 1960s, for example, when the U.S. was involved in a very unpopular war in Vietnam?
Yeah, so I think that's another thing. I mean, I think it's a really important point. And like, this is a group of people. I mean, really, in some ways, like who we're describing as like the baby boomers and then beyond. But the first sort of wave of this are people who were in, you know, probably in college or graduate school during the Vietnam War, which gives them a particular kind of both certain forms of opposition to the United States as like forms of imperial practices, but also like a real kind of real distrust of big bureaucracies. And so one of the things that, I mean, and this is like becomes sort of like pervasive, and then also watching things like Watergate, seeing sort of the problems of this kind of like these big, like the big state institutions. So even though these are people who are joining in some ways, and oftentimes it's like a group that is part of the kind of revolving door as well, but like who go into government, they have certain kinds of skepticism about big bureaucracy. And so one of their ideas is to make government like both more transparent, but also in some ways like more efficient. So it's not about this kind of growth of the administrative state. It's in some ways about its reduction. One of the essays in our volume by Sarah Myloff and Ruhl Schiller looks at the group of kind of like interns who go to work for Ralph Nader. And I actually think they are a great kind of representation of this this ethos. And so these are very like sort of idealistic people who come of age in the late 1960s, who sort of really believe in the kind of the project that Ralph Nader is involved in, which in many ways is calling, like is there to call to task some of the problems with the kind of with the parts of the administrative state, and to sort of make government in some ways. It's not anti-government, but it's there to make government work better. But doing that through like highly like the research and like highly technical approaches. So I think one of the other pieces of this is that like it in some ways, and this goes to being sort of professional class, it actually relies on this like heavily kind of like elite knowledge. So this idea like you only understand this because you're like you've had this particular type of training. And I do think one point just to like highlight, and something that if my co-author Brent, if he was here, he always brings up, but is like the sort of federal government and state by the 70s and 80s and beyond, like what is really complicated. So you actually like, it's not to say like they should like you need, you know, like you should have no expertise if you're going into kind of a position like that. But in some ways, it's this idea of like, because that only we know how this works or understands. And like, it actually creates this kind of like disconnect from kind of like the larger public. And I think another thing that I find really important about this particular move, and I've looked at this in both this this project, but also in my other work, is the ways in which like this approach and this kind of thinking about like kind of what liberalism is or the Democratic Party is in many ways quite averse to both kind of certain forms of like collective action, but particularly like kind of labor unions. And in some ways, some of this has to do with the ways in which like unions themselves have become quite bureaucratic by the early 1970s. You have like lots of like sort of big corruption within unions, but also like that kind of approach as not really what is kind of best for both the kind of liberal project, but also kind of for governance. And I think another thing is like, even though many of these people came of age in the kind of amongst the 60s protest movements, they're also very averse to like big mass democracy. Like they see that as kind of like messy and uncontrollable. And so if you're a lawyer, and I was like, I don't mean to hate on all lawyers. I'm married to one and the daughter of one, but they like to be able to control. I think there's some often like to be able to like control things. I mean, that's one thing about the law. And often like big mass democracy, like big protests or other kinds of like mass collective action don't always fit into that kind of that thinking.
I'm speaking with historian Lily Geismer, co-editor of Mastery and Drift, Professional Class Liberals Since the 1960s. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. Well then, Lily, just in keeping with what you were just talking about the unease of professional class liberals with mass action, collective action on a mass scale, you know, the 1970s definitely was a crucial decade in shaping their ideas. And of course, one of the things that many people have noted about that decade is it was the end of mass membership-based movements on the left. Unions persisted, but of course, the 70s, the 80s were a time also when the labor movement went into decline. You know, when we think about those changes that have happened in terms of mass membership-based organizing, do you think the liberals reacted to the decline of those movements? Could we pin some of the decline of those movements on professional class liberals? What would you say?
Yeah, I think there's this complicated, I mean, and this is another thing we highlight in the volume, is this like sort of complicated relationship between like liberalism and the left, which often become conflated largely, I think, because, I mean, that they do have sort of, there's some aspects of similarities, but also because of like having a two-party system. You know, so that they sort of are forced together in certain kinds of coalitions. And one thing I think that like historically, like when we've seen liberalism kind of at its finest, it has been when it's been pushed on issues by members of the left or by social movements, you know, famously with the civil rights movement, but I think also very much in the kind of the like the most sort of progressive aspects of the New Deal came from pressure from organized labor and other kinds of like progressive groups to kind of push for some of its most kind of socially democratic components. But what I think starts to happen is both kind of frustrations with some of those some of those movements amongst kind of this particular kind of professional class or embracing certain aspects of them. I mean, definitely like a commitment to a certain version of equal rights, but ones that are not connected to like a broader, more expansive vision. Understanding of redistribution. And I don't think you can like, it's like solely the fault of professional class liberals that you have a decline in organized labor in the 1970s and beyond. Like, I mean, a lot of it has to do with like much, much more structural changes in the American and global economy. But I don't think that this was, that like that became a priority by any means. And an understanding that like the faith and that like, the future of the party lay, you know, especially in kind of post-industrial sectors. So that being really important. So like things like tech, finance, and trade, and which are often kind of have really low union density, but also just sort of like those kinds of people were not central to kind of who the Democratic Party's vision was. And this is another kind of key theme that comes up in our volume. Was the rise, another thing you see is a rise of this kind of new kind of technical approach or professional class approach is actually like in the approach to actual campaigns and elections and the increased use of things like consultants and strategists who think much more in sort of micro-targeting particular kinds of voters, understanding like sort of how one of our authors calls, Arthur Julie Kohlerhausen calls like sculpting the electorate. So that goes to this kind of aversion to particular kinds of mass democracy and instead an effort to like control both the democratic process, but also who is part of the Democratic Party. And that comes to reshape the party in a variety of different ways, but I think also what we see happening and especially seen happen in the last 15 years is to create like wide scale amounts of alienation and frustration from certain groups to the Democrats.
How did the rise of Reagan and the new right shape the ideas, the politics of professional class liberals? You know, it's often said that the Democratic Party liberalism moved to the right. Is that enough of an explanation that the rise, the power of Reaganism the right more broadly created a kind of pole of attraction, or is it more complicated?
Yeah, I think it's more complicated. I mean, I think that there's often this idea that like, and I think it's actually hard to kind of put some of the categories in like left and right terms, because on certain issues, like Democrats become, you know, especially on issues around race, around gender, around sexuality, like actually could be seen as like more to the left, you know, traditionally to the left in the 80s and beyond. But I think that the issue is like, this is not like sort of just thinking about everything the Democrats do is like a reaction to the Reagan right misses the ways in which like they themselves, like in this, like this sort of, I guess I'm like group of people, and this is something I look at extensively in my own book Left Behind, but it is a theme here too. Believe in certain ideas that could be sort of associated with Reagan and sort of and adopt them in their own particular kind of way, which is distinctive from the ways that Reagan or the Republican Party operate. And so I think in some ways this goes to like a certain kind of understanding of market-based approaches, which Reagan is very much associated with. And you can see this play out, like our book looks at this in a number of different registers or categories. One would be like the kind of faith in like outsourcing to consultants and contractors certain a variety of different kinds of work, which has a long history. Another would be the approach that like which our author Karen Tani looks at, especially around disability, is like approaching like things in like with a cost benefit analysis. And that goes to kind of bringing in certain kinds of like economic or legalistic training. But that like that's how you think about government is in terms of like cost benefits. I would say another thing that we look at is like in terms of like how to approach things like welfare reform, which is like in a far more like sort of technical way. And it's like that Mark Aidenoff looks at in trying to sort of accrue alimony payments. So those are kind of things that I think are often affiliated with or associated with the Reagan right. But actually, like one thing that we argue is it actually emerges in many ways out of this kind of remaking of liberalism.
And then in trying to understand some of that, how would you say that professional class liberals related to, were connected to, helped shape neoliberalism itself, you know, which is often dated to the 1970s, 1980s. And although certainly Reagan is one figure in that story, the effort to remake the economy along lines that slash public services and constraints on businesses, often described as a kind of heightened class war from above, has been a bipartisan affair. I don't want to get too far ahead in the story, but how did professional class liberals think about capitalism more broadly and the market and what we might call neoliberalism as it developed?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple things. One of the things, and we talked about this in the introduction to the book, is like you could sort of just categorize this just like as just neoliberal and kind of call it a day. One thing, and what we were trying to sort of show is the ways in which like that actually like this is in some ways like one pathway to neoliberalism or like a certain variant of it. But in actually like using the term neoliberalism in some ways like obscure more than it illuminates. And we were struck by the fact like this group of people like doesn't see themselves necessarily as like neoliberal or what they're doing is neoliberal. And instead like this had this commitment to liberalism itself. And so that's one thing we really wanted to kind of like understand. In my larger work, I've looked at this question around neoliberalism extensively. And have thought a lot about the kind of like that there's like a democratic version of neoliberalism, which I think you can see those ideas inform this project too. But this has its roots in many ways, like in the New Deal itself. And I think one thing that there's a longstanding trend of what is what we think of as neoliberalism that is within liberalism. And I will say to the question of like the kind of faith in the markets, faith in capitalism, that is a sort of key component here, but it's a belief in kind of markets and capitalism to in some ways like address particular kinds of traditionally liberal goals. So that goes back to like the kinds of cost benefit analysis. That's like very much like market thinking, but the idea is like applying that those kinds of like logics to the kind of like to make government work more like efficiently and effectively. Another idea is like if you kind of promote, if you promote market capitalism, that will like help everyone. And like that's the kind of idealistic thinking. And so that this is like if you can like that the like making the market sort of do good, which is something I've looked at in my other work. And so I think that that's at the heart of this. But it's not actually thinking about like what you miss in those that kind of thinking is like an effort to kind of at all address create like a kind of any sort of any form of like a redistributive system, or in many ways to think about capitalism's like many downsides. So some of that logic becomes kind of left out. And you have certain kinds of people. I mean, we have another, one of our other essays looks at Robert Rubin. David Stein has an essay on Robert Rubin and like the kind of rise of like deficit hawks, which is really about kind of trying to like make the system work in various different ways to kind of like promote certain versions of capitalism that then are there to like in turn to help people. And so that is a little bit different than I would say the kinds of approaches that you see coming out of the kind of Reagan Revolution.
Would it be fair to say that the kind of wonkiness that seems the hallmark of professional class liberalism, you know, a notion that it's above ideology, that it's just pragmatic, that through these technical fixes, appeal to basing things on data and evidence, that one can come up with solutions, that that whole approach, in a sense, kind of forecloses thinking much more broadly about systemic change because it's such a kind of narrow horizon to be operating within?
Yeah, absolutely. That like that really like you crystallized so much of our argument. I mean, so that's the kind of idea is like you're actually like if you're just focused on these like tweaks to the system and like making the system work better, which I think goes to both capitalism but also to like forms of governance, that you don't think more about kind of like fund like these like large scale change. And actually, I mean, I think in many ways in my larger work I've looked extensively at the Clinton administration. And you see a lot, I mean, that's one, you know, Clinton has multitudes, but like a lot of it is this kind of like real wonkiness of him and his administration. But I think where you really see this logic come into being is in the Obama administration. And so we have a chapter at the end about the kind of professional class liberalism in Obama. And that to me is like the apotheosis of this approach and this kind of thinking. So it's so much of the Obama era was about this kind of like tweaking the system, trying to find fixes with like sort of like highly technical approaches to problems that were much, much bigger in scale. And so I think that's one of the things come out that you can see. And we talk about this a little bit in our introduction, but in many ways, this project like is all, it's a group of people who all sort of came of age in the eras of Clinton and Obama and comes from like certain kinds of frustrations with like the real limitations of those visions and sort of trying to think through how and why they were so sort of constrained.
Well, let's talk about the first of those, you know, the 1992 election of Bill Clinton and then his 8-year presidency, which, as you say, you've written about pretty extensively. How do you think that first of that presidency was both the product of the vision of this professional class of a liberal sort and also then help reshape what American liberalism seemed to mean and what the Democratic Party was about?
Yeah, I think this is why I think the Clinton era is like really fundamental to this moment of kind of sort of transformation of the party, both in terms of its like electoral strategy, and that actually like you know we see this play out, and I've talked about this extensively elsewhere, but like time and time again of like the Democrats trying to like replicate the Clinton coalition or presidency in a number of different ways. But I think that a lot of the Clinton era was this kind of like high, like the people who came into office with a kind of like highly technical approach, both to kind of how to like economic policy, but like policies more broadly, that were like sort of the antithesis of many ways of like a redistributive approach to things like social policy. And instead it's like this, we see this like evisceration of the social safety net. And instead of faith in kind of like the market to solve these various different problems, I mean, I think that the like this is like where kind of like we through kind of a system of free market capitalism, you will have that, like that's what will bring kind of equality, but also like democracy, both in the United States and abroad. So I think that like that comes to shape the both the Democratic Party's vision, but also like so many of its the sort of fundamental problems, not just of the Democratic Party, but the United States more broadly, emerges from this era and this particular kind of approach. But I think one of the things that is becomes a challenge is that like it proves in certain ways successful. So there's been this like ongoing effort to kind of replicate this and see this as the approach of like what America, like as like a popular approach. And that in itself has created like sort of a host of fundamental problems over the ensuing 25 years.
I'm speaking with Lily Geismar. She's co-editor of Mastery and Drift, Professional Class Liberals Since the 1960s. She's professor of history at Claremont McKenna College. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So during the period of time we've talked about so far, during the 80s, during the 90s under Clinton, with the kind of reshaping of what liberalism was supposed to mean by this professional class, was that pretty uncontested, or at the time were there those within the coalition that made up the Democratic Party who were not happy about the direction things were being pulled in?
Yeah, this is a big question, and this is something I've looked at more in my book Left Behind, which was like, where was the kind of opposition to this? I mean, especially within the Democratic Party itself. And I think you don't, like, it, like, you have places, and on particular issues there was quite a lot of opposition. So like around issues like welfare, I mean, you have both advocates for the poor, but also feminists and other groups like really coming at, like really advocating against welfare reform. You have around NAFTA and free trade, both like environmental groups, labor groups, human rights groups, opposing the policies. But there wasn't a kind of like consistent unified left to push at the Clinton administration. And I think you can look back at where people were saying certain things at the time, but it wasn't like an ongoing pressure that I do think enabled and allowed certain kinds of approaches to come through. And some of this had to do with this, like, I think fear after the kind of 12 years of the Reagan-Bush years, that like this idea that like it's better to have a Democrat than Republicans in office. And so this is sort of, you have to like make do in some ways. But I think that that had its own sort of limitations and failures. I do think under Obama, and then we've seen this, I mean, I think this particularly became true under Biden, that they were confronting a much more sort of active and organized left, which did come to like shape their approaches in different kinds of ways than you see happen under Bill Clinton.
We've been talking a lot about things at the level of the state and how professional class liberals with their technocratic approach helped change the U.S. state. But how did this class also reshape the other realms in which it was especially active and influential, you know, in the media, in higher education, and philanthropy?
One thing I just want to say from that I hadn't said previously, but I think is actually really important and a theme I always try to emphasize, is that like I think one thing about this question of like the not pushing back or not like the kind of investment in this is like this system worked for professional class people. So there's like not a kind of like reason to challenge it. So if you're the people in office, or you're the like in positions and you're like you're promoting particular kind of policies that like favor your particular group, there's not a kind of in some ways a desire to change that. So I think that plays a key role in this. But I think that this is the point that you raise is really important about one of the themes that we try to say this. So this is not just about government, or it's about government working with other kinds of groups, but you also see this kind of this like in a number of different ways, like this highly kind of like professionalized liberal ethos emerging in other kinds of places. So philanthropy becomes a really critical place where, you know, there's a, and Lila Berman has a great essay on this question of like the, both in terms of governments, like increasing like reliance on philanthropy to kind of do particular kinds of work, but also in the approaches that philanthropy comes to take, which also focus like heavily on these kinds of, this like market-based thinking, these questions around kind of, also in terms of the sort of thinking about cost benefit and using kind of market ideology to kind of promote certain kinds of like philanthropic goals. I think the other part that that philanthropy like relies heavily on like high concentrations of wealth. So I mean, in some ways, like you have the philanthropic employees at large foundations who are sort of administering it, but it does rely on this kind of high concentration of wealth, which I do think emerges from, you know, a set of what we could think of as neoliberal policies since 1970s. I think the other side with media is really important. And Dylan Gottlieb has a really fascinating piece. I think anyone who is a media consumer, but also been in the media, can find it really chilling, which is about the kind of class-based transformation of journalism, and how it became much, much more kind of this upper middle class, like sort of cohort of people who are in media. And that's had a variety of different kind of impacts on both the like approaches, things that get covered in various different questions, but also like one of the things that happens is like the decline of kind of certain kinds of collective action of employees themselves. I mean, so there has been a return to unionization amongst certain journalists, but that had really been in severe decline for much of the kind of late 20th century. So those are places that you can see it. And I think in some ways, like you with higher education, this is almost cyclical. I mean, so you both have, we talked about how higher ed becomes like one of the kinds of key engines of this happening, but it then kind of comes to reshape higher education itself. And so you can see that in administration in all kinds of ways. And for any of us, any person who spends a lot of time in higher ed, there's all kinds of ways that this plays out. But Gabe Winon has a piece about actually how it like came to shape like the study of history and the kinds of questions that historians ask or approach, which had to do much more with kind of thinking like about sort of like internally to questions of the state and state action, as opposed to like far more radical like and expansive visions about power.
Lily Geismar, I wanted to ask you about the global financial crisis and the election of Barack Obama, a period after which has been roiled by crises. What role did the global financial crisis play for professional class liberalism? I mean, to what degree were they implicated in it in the first place? And then how did it shape the rise of Obama and the fortunes of this cohort politically?
Well, I think in the short term, you know, it had certain kinds of benefits for Obama and the kind of professional class around him. I mean, Obama. And so, I mean, I think that, you know, Obama is running in the fall of 2008. And so in some ways, like the financial crisis, like helps his political fortunes in various different ways. And this kind of this idea that like this like you're going to have a new generation, a new approach coming in, and the kind of language of hope and change. But I think what you see happening is that like the types of people that Obama brings in are very much tied to some of these older approaches of, you know, and many of them are Clinton administration alumni who are invested in kind of like making the system, like it's not about like a moment to reshape the system, but like getting it to work again. And so I think what happens is like the ways in which like the kinds of like with the bailouts, but other kinds of the kind of reconstructions that happen after in the aftermath of the financial crisis to the economy, especially is around the tech industry. So Obama's like real approach and commitment to like these ideas of like entrepreneurship, meritocracy, that really kind of come together around the tech industry, like that really benefits certain sectors of the of the population, and not other ones. And so I think that in many ways, like the kinds of frustrations with Obama's approach, which, like, we all, you know, I imagine most of the people, you or most people who are listening, like, got to experience this in real time as I did, but didn't really fully understand it, so much that this, like, growing hostility and frustration, and seeing this kind of, like, 30 years of the Democratic Party just, like, not particularly speaking to them, leads to kind of much of the kinds of political frustrations that I think emerge on both the left and the right, in 2015 and 2016 that we've seen play out over the last decade. And I think, you know, the other part of it is, like, both in terms of, like, I would say with Obama and Clinton, but, like, often spoke in this very, like, expansive language that, like, didn't, you know, that, like, in some ways could bring together different people, like, you know, was, like, sort of cross class. But in much of the strategy was really targeted and geared towards like sort of upper middle class people. I mean, understanding that as the kind of groups that should be targeted, not really like, you know, Obama did not make like bolstering unions sort of like fundamental to the vision, or much about the kind of addressing like the needs of the working class. And so I think that also leads to a lot of the kinds of like frustrations and animosity that that we have witnessed against Democrats in the last decade.
Right. And the crisis of liberalism of the Democratic Party has been so pronounced. And, you know, and on the one hand, this kind of sense of a group of people who are completely clueless about the world around them and focused in very, very narrow ways on quantifying things technically and drawing conclusions in that way. And I guess connected to that, the media's lack of awareness of the prospects of Trump in 2016, you know, being blindsided by that. On the other hand, people within the professional class of liberalism have seen their fortunes change, and you can't have this conversation without at least referencing the term that Barbara and John Ehrenreich came up with in the 70s for the PMC, the professional managerial class, which has been used as a term of derision by people on the left about privileged workers, managers who may not be in the political class themselves, but maybe supporting it, and who might be socially progressive on the one hand, but then not supportive of economic redistribution, not aware of class. And yet, you know, in a moment like this, we've seen the kind of erosion of the situation for quite a few people in that world. And as you mentioned, you know, some of them in the media have actually joined unions. How would you characterize the sort of contradictions that exist for people within that class, both as those who have been characterized as blind to the world around them, but then often are some of the same people who we can see are being pulled leftward?
Yeah, I think that that's a really great question, and one that I've like sort of wrestled with on all levels, probably, like, both in terms of my professional work, but then also like personally. I mean, one thing that we talk about this is like, the book is written by academics, so we are all people who like are part of in some ways are part of this professional class. Like, we all have advanced degrees and various other things. And so I think, I mean, one thing that you can really see is if you're within the realm of academia, of watching these types of changes play out. So in an area that sort of felt like it was kind of like immune to certain changes, like, it's been deeply confronted with it actually. Like, I mean, I think really since 2008, if not earlier. But I would say one of the questions, this goes back to like the initial question you asked me about the right, is that so often the focus has been on the problems of the Trump administration, and that is a kind of like scapegoat for all problems. And I'm not going to say that like there hasn't been like severe disruptions that have come from that, but I do think that like one of the things that's really important for professionally people who are like identify with the Democratic Party and who might be part of like a professional class, like, is to like look inward to some degree and sort of to think about some of these fundamental contradictions and fundamental limitations to liberalism itself. And I think we've seen this, like, I mean, the one that I thought about a lot, and this is not to say that I'm like against democracy, but like that was going to be Biden's like main, you know, the main focus of his campaign, which in some ways like is a very like sort of professional class idea, like idea, which is to like a focus on the kind of like these like norms, this kind of like existing system as a as opposed to thinking much more expansively about the kind of larger the problems and what most Americans need right now, which, you know, they need democracy, but they also need like to feel a sense of like security and stability economically, in terms of climate, in terms of a lot of other things. So that's where I see some of these issues play out, that like no one is really you know, immune from it in any way, but like just looking to externally to Trump misses some of that. And I do think a lot of this is going on. Like, I think that there has been so much frustration with the Democrats in the last really in the last year, and other models or possibilities sort of like coming to the fore that are really important.
To draw that out further, the election of Zoran Mamdani, Democratic Socialist, as mayor of New York, you know, has really brought into, I think, full view the fraught relationship of establishment liberalism and the left. And the Democratic Party did pretty much everything it could to keep him from being mayor, which, you know, echoes similar efforts, although those were actually successful, to keep Bernie Sanders from becoming the Democratic presidential candidate earlier. You mentioned that the left and liberalism have had a long, complicated relationship, partly because people on the left often find themselves in coalition with liberals because there are no other formations, you know, outside of the Democratic Party. But where do you see this relationship now between the left and establishment liberalism?
Yeah, I think it's at a real fundamental crossroads. I think this tension and has been always been there, and it becomes pronounced at particular kinds of moments. And I think, you know, we saw it break out into the open in 2016 and then kind of be tamped down. But I think that what we're seeing happen is that being played out, and especially as like the left has become more organized, more vocal, and having a kind of clear vision, that has become like ever more seen as a threat. And so I mean, the hope is that, like, you know, I think one of the things that came out of the 2024 election was like a need for a reckoning, especially amongst like sort of establishment or like professional class, people. And I will say, like, it does seem like Mamdani actually captured like a certain, you know, some of the kind of professional class in New York, as well. Like, he did well within, this sort of certain parts of that cohort, but I think that there's an this is one of the things of like an opportunity to kind of move towards something different. But I think for many establishment Democrats, that seems like so fundamentally scary. So there's also ways of reading the election, you know, of 2025 and looking to like the models of like New Jersey and Virginia as the approach to go to. So I think that's sort of, there's going to have to be this like sort of ongoing and continual, both pressure, but like rethinking.
Well, let me end by asking you about the Democratic Party kind of into the future. So the party is widely reviled, and its fortunes only seem to be lifted by voters who, you know, hate Trump even more and hence vote for the Democrats. And much of the ire toward the Democratic Party is from those who probably will vote for them anyway. And so I wanted to ask you, is it reasonable for those discontented people to expect the Democratic Party under pressure to be able to change from its narrow technocratic approach, which is never about great economic redistribution, and also is one of the hallmarks seems to be an emphasis on bipartisanship, which, you know, rankles so many people right now, given what the Republicans are. Do you think it's reasonable for people to think that the party can change away from all of that?
I would hope so. I mean, I think one thing that I always like have focused on, and this is my question, like of looking to like Democratic, like the transformation of the party, is like the party has changed before. So it's not been like static. So there is the possibility for change. And, you know, much of that came out of like a certain kind of recognition or like frustrations with like a previous generation of what Democrats were. And I don't endorse the ways in which it moved, but it is that move is possible. I think the other thing, and I think that like that that idea of like, and that's something we look at in the book extensively, is like this like ongoing commitment to bipartisanship in the face, and this is, you can see this especially among with Obama, in the face of like this of a Republican Party that like no like makes that all but impossible. You know, there is some kind of understanding of that no longer working, and I think that's a short term solution. But I think the other thing that is really important that I like the where I sometimes get like both depressed and hope from is to think about like the evisceration of the federal government. And so it's actually a moment for like reconstruction in some ways and like for new ideas to come in. And so I think that like the combination of the party's like electoral fortunes, but also this like what has happened to basic government, like federal government institutions, do open up some potential for movement and for change. And then I think that's why, you know, one of the reasons that you know, I think where the Mamdani election both is like really significant, but has also become really important as a symbol of that.
Lily, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Lily Geismer is professor of history at Claremont McKenna College. We've been discussing Mastery and Drift, Professional Class Liberals since the 1960s, which she co-edited with Brent Siebel. She is also the author of Left Behind, The Democrats' Failed Attempt to Solve Inequality. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.